Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, Finn at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. Thank you for loading me down and queuing me up, and I hope you enjoy the show. Our story today is about the last Wild West outlaw, a fellow named Harry Tracy. Well, his real name was Tracy Severn, but we'll get to that in a minute. His moment of glory, or his blaze of glory, or whatever you want to call it, was a bloody Oregon jailbreak that he undertook and shot and punched his way through much of Oregon and Washington, and finally was gunned down in that wheat field in eastern Washington. He was a gunfighter from Butch Cassidy's Wild Bunch, the hole-in-the-wall gang, trying to shoot his way back to Idaho and rejoin the gang after breaking out of the state pen. Killed 11 men before he was shot down. Harry Tracy was famously described by Stuart Holbrook as a, quote, garden variety idiot. Not sure that's exactly true, but he certainly, well, there has to be something in it, because after all, the guy's specialty was breaking out of jails. In order to be an expert in breaking out of jails, you have to be pretty bad at not getting chucked into them in the first place. Well, let's get to it. This story was first written and published in the newspapers on July 11th, 2010, and I'm going to go ahead and read it to you, starting now. The golden age of outlaws lasted from just after the Civil War until the turn of the century, when they ran out of places to hide from the law. But did you know that the last of these outlaws, an associate of Butch Cassidy, lived and worked in Oregon? Dapper, charming, and deadly, 27-year-old Harry Tracy was Oregon's only connection to the world of professional Western outlaws such as Jesse James and the Dalton brothers. By the standards of his peers, he wasn't a particularly successful robber, but he was remarkably adept at breaking out of jail, and it's for this, in particular for a bloody breakout from the state pen in 1902, followed by an even bloodier two-month manhunt, it's for this that he's most remembered today. Harry Tracy was on the run after breaking out of prisons in Utah and Colorado when he came to Portland back in 1898. He soon met up with a local rowdy by the name of David Merrill. He and Merrill became friends, and Tracy became more than friends with Merrill's sister Rose. The two of them were married shortly after they met. Everything was great until the money gave out, and Tracy and Merrill had to go out and get more. This they did with a particular style and panache that quickly got them into the headlines as the McIntosh Bandits and the False Face Bandits. But although Tracy was a stranger to them, police already knew Merrill very well. He was on their list of usual suspects, so of course they sent a detective out to check him out. Police found him hiding upstairs, no doubt surrounded with stolen goods. Under questioning, he told them about Tracy. When Tracy came back to the house, he figured out that something was up, and he ran for it. After trading pistol shots with the detective, he jumped a train to flee. By an odd stroke of luck, the conductor disabled the train right next to a butcher shop that Tracy had robbed earlier, and the butcher's son was ready with a shotgun full of birdshot, which he let Tracy have at relatively close range. The badly wounded robber managed to run a short distance, but he did eventually give up and was sent off first to the hospital and then to serve a 20-year stretch at the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem. Well, once in the pen, Tracy got started doing what Tracy did best, planning an escape. Having somehow arranged for some money to be sneaked in for him, he bribed someone, no one knows who, to hide a pair of Winchester carbines in a pattern box in the prison foundry. Then he bribed a soon-to-be-released inmate named Harry Wright to get a rope ladder and toss it over the prison wall one night. On the morning of June 9th, 1902, everything was ready to go. Tracy and Merrill opened the box, got out the rifles, gunned down two guards immediately, and started the breakout. By the time they'd gotten out of the prison yard, they'd killed four guards and wounded a fellow inmate. A fifth guard, shot and dying, was used as a human shield until they got outside, at which point Tracy put a final bullet through his head, and the two men ran for it. Thus was begun a two-month manhunt covering most of northwest Oregon and much of western Washington, as Tracy and Merrill tried to get back to Hole-in-the-Wall, Idaho, headquarters of the Wild Bunch gang, not knowing that Cassidy and company had fled to Argentina the previous year. They were headed for Washington, stopping when they had to get a meal or even a bed at farmhouses along the way because, after all, who would deny hospitality to a couple of armed, desperate men? Bloodhounds were called down from Walla Walla. Tracy sneaked around and mixed his scent with that of the pursuing posses, confusing the dogs. Then the governor announced an $8,000 reward for the two men's capture, alive or dead. This may have been even worse. It inspired dozens of ad hoc citizen posses to pour out of saloons from Salem to Seattle, most of them thoroughly braced with spirits and all of them dangerously armed. The result was a chaotic landscape of heavily armed drunks looking hopefully over every backyard fence for Tracy and Merrill. Quote,
"The whole damn country was full of militia and many of the boys were potted,"
Detective Joe Day of the Portland Police Department told writer Stuart Holbrook many years later.
"They shot at everything, and Clark and Cowlitz County sounded like the Spanish-American War all over again. It was the most dangerous place I was ever in."
Well, these boozy posses may have made the countryside dangerous for everyone, but they were no match for a professional killer like Tracy. On the few occasions when they found their quarry, they quickly found themselves wishing they had not. After crossing the Columbia, Tracy shot his brother-in-law dead. Some sources say he read in a newspaper that Merrill had cut a deal to deliver Tracy in exchange for a reduced sentence. In any case, he was now on his own, and he continued making for Hole in the Wall. Tracy made it as far as Creston, beyond the Snoqualmie Pass, before he was pinned down by police in a wheat field, and after taking a bullet that cut a leg artery and another one that broke his other leg, the dying bandit put himself out of his misery with his Colt 45. Tracy had been on the lam for 58 days, had killed 11 people along the way, not counting himself. During that time, he'd furnished eager newspaper readers with a gripping story, and by the end, he was the most famous person in the country. When he was finally dead, souvenir hunters stripped his corpse bare of clothes and hair, and authorities felt it was necessary to melt his face off with vitriol, that is, sulfuric acid, so that his corpse would not be dug up and put on display by some enterprising body snatcher later on. There is some reason to suspect that there was another reason that they melted his face off with vitriol. Specifically, there are people who think that Tracy was not actually the man that was shot in that wheat field, that it was a different man. One of his fellow prison inmates made this suggestion after his body was brought back, and he noticed that the ankle didn't quite look the same as what he had remembered from the prison washroom. I guess we'll never really know about that. Tracy was the last of a dying breed, the breed of the hard-living, deadly American outlaw. A few years later, the rest of the hole-in-the-wall gang, having been tracked down and identified by Pinkerton detectives, would be wiped out by a detachment of Bolivian soldiers. America was changing, and with it Oregon. There was no room for men like Harry Tracy in the new America. Not even in the wild, rough, frontier state of Oregon. Here's an afterword. After this article was published in the Creswell Chronicle, a gentleman from Wisconsin named Jim Gardner got in touch with me. Jim, it turns out, is related to Harry Tracy, whose real name was Severn, Tracy Severn. Tracy's family was not proud of him, and when he died, the Severns did not exactly rush to publicize the connection. In an age that had great faith in the power of genetics, having a vicious killer in the family made the neighbors wonder about the rest of one's clan. You know, the old apple falling not far from the tree idea. Enough time has gone by, though, for Jim to be comfortable telling the full story, which he did in a journal of the Outlaw Lawman History Association in three articles in the early 1990s. Tracy grew up in Pittsville, Wisconsin, a child of a highly respected and successful family, and as a youngster, he gave no sign of any predilection to a life of crime and murder. One critical item to keep in mind, if you are going to do any further research on the Harry Tracy story, is the remarkably low quality of some of the historical sources on this event. There is something about an outlaw story that seems to bring out the liar in writers. Of particular note, Jim tells us, is an article by Ray Hastings in True West magazine, published in 1972, which claims, among other things, that the young Tracy raped and killed his Sunday school teacher. As I learned when doing the research for this story, it's hardly the only historical account of Tracy's life whose author enhanced it a bit. You will need to crank up the sensitivity level of your BS detector to the max for this one. Also, in the early 1920s, a fellow inmate of Tracy and Merrill, who identifies himself only as prisoner number 6435, wrote a very illuminating account of this breakout, and you'll find a link to his story on the website at offbeatoregon.com. And that's the story of Harry Tracy. Well, that's it for our show for today. This show is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. In addition to this podcast, it includes a weekly newspaper column, a daily RSS feed to catch on your smartphone reader, a Facebook page, a Twitter feed, and a couple other minor components. Photographs and other images that go with today's show are on offbeatoregon.com, where you'll also find full citations to the sources used in writing this story, along with more than 200 other articles written over the last 5 years, all organized by date of publication. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, and was written by Carmen Ficarra. I do Offbeat Oregon for learning and for fun, so I don't sell advertising or ask for donations, but if you feel a need to make a donation anyway, may I suggest that you buy a copy of my book instead? It's called Wicked Portland, The Wild and Lusty Underworld of a Frontier Seaport Town, published by the History Press in 2012. You can order it from the store link on offbeatoregon.com if you'd like, but if you still have a local community bookstore in your town, I hope you'll consider buying it from them instead. It sells for $20. Finally, if you're ever in Corvallis, drop me a line. Maybe we can grab a cup of coffee and talk about history. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com. Don't be a stranger, especially don't be a stranger if you have a good idea for one of these columns in the future. Speaking of the future, our next show will be coming your way at around 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. And until then, go out and fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.